loves you. She wanted to be there for you. We both did. Thanks. We're still your friends, you know, Elle and me. And Steven, even though he can't really look at you without turning into a sad country love song. I know. I don't know what else to say. I know. A shadow falls over us. It's Mom. She looks pale. Hello, Jill, she says faintly. Hello, Mama Riggs, Jill responds, the name my friends always called my mother, like they were claiming her as their mother, too. Normally, Mom would make small talk in a situation like this, but I can tell she's exhausted. Are you ready to head home? She asks me. I jump up. Yes.
I'll see you in the funny papers,
Jill says as we walk away, her signature closing line. Yeah, I think. Hopefully, I'll see you there. At home, Mom goes straight into her bedroom and closes the door. I watch TV in the downstairs den. It's a risk, hanging out so close to Ty's room. One never knows when something mind-bending might happen there. But I need something to occupy my brain. There's no sign of Ty, thankfully. No brute, no reflections, no shadows. For once, I feel completely alone. I channel surf with the TV muted for a while so I don't disturb Mom. I watch TMZ, which is pretty self-explanatory without the sound, and an episode of Cops. Then I land on the 6 o'clock news. I can tell instantly by the background that the story is about Patrick Murphy. The reporter is standing in the train yard. She's young and pretty, with that white blonde hair that almost looks silver in the sunshine, but her eyes are reluctant, like this isn't the kind of story she wants to be reporting on. I turn up the sound.
The second death in this small town this year, and the 17th teen suicide in the state of Nebraska in the last 12 months. As the community of Raymond gathers together today to mourn the loss of one of its brightest young stars, they are left with some haunting questions. What happened to this fun-loving, straight-A student and swim team state champion to make him throw away the bright future that was ahead of him? What led him to this empty train yard? And how could this senseless tragedy have been prevented?
I hear Mom stirring upstairs and mute the television again. As the reporter wraps up the story, they run a stock photo of Wayuka Cemetery, zooming in on a stone angel gazing stoically at the ground. I see an internet address, www.youthsuicideprevention.nebraska.edu, scroll across the bottom of the screen. Then Patrick's face. Then the weather. My heart is beating fast. My fists are clenched, my jaw tight. I shouldn't have been surprised by the story. I shouldn't get so worked up about it. But the weight of the day is crushing me. 17 teen suicides. 17. I've flipped through Mom's books. I know that 17 is not so many when you consider that more than 30,000 people die from suicide in the U.S. every year, the 10th leading cause of death, the 3rd leading cause among teens. I could spout statistics, warning signs we should have heeded, factors that put Ty at risk. He lived in a house where there were guns present, which made him 5.4 times more likely to die by suicide. He came from what would be classified as a broken home, which made him 3 times more likely. He was male, which made him 5 times more likely, since females attempt suicide more often, but males actually succeed at it with more consistency. Ty had recently suffered a breakup or a broken heart, or whatever did happen with Ashley. His grades had been sliding. He'd been up and down. He'd been depressed. He'd tried it once before. I could tell you all the factors that made him a prime candidate for the 6 o'clock news, but I couldn't tell you why he did it. I turn off the TV and head back upstairs. I'm standing at the kitchen window drinking a glass of water when I notice that the playhouse light is on. Outside, at the edge of the back lawn, its windows are glowing brightly. It's been ages since I've been in the playhouse, years probably. I tromp through the snowy yard and try the door. It's unlocked. It swings open soundlessly. Hello? I say, a bit nervous. I do not want to find a burglar or a squatter. Not that there's anything valuable to steal, or that squatters hang around kids' abandoned playhouses in Raymond, Nebraska, in weather that's well below freezing. but you never know. Is anybody in here? I call. No answer. It smells old inside, like dead flies and dust. The curtains, which were once bright and cheery, are so faded I almost can't tell what color they used to be. There's a grungy layer of dirt all over everything, scuffing under my feet. I spot an old mousetrap in the corner, unsprung with a dried-up hunk of cheese on it. I right a chair that is lying sideways on the floor. The floor above my head creaks, like there's someone in the loft. My heart starts doing calisthenics. I grab an old toy-sized broom from next to the play kitchen. It's not my weapon of choice, but if somebody is going to jump out at me, I could inflict some real injury with this thing. Or something. Maybe it's a raccoon, I reason. Or a possum. I shudder. I hate possums. Slowly, oh so slowly, I climb the ladder to the loft. Then I flip on the light. Zap! I expect something to come flying out at me, but nothing does. I remember to breathe out. I remember to breathe in. Out. In. Phew. I'm getting sick of the there's no one there game. I look around. It's like a shrine to my childhood up here. Dusty dolls and their various accessories line the walls. A tiny crib, a doll-sized stroller, a miniature changing table. In another corner, there's a stack of old Barbies and their clothes, and a virtual army of My Little Ponies, which were my favorite back in the day. What little girl doesn't love My Little Pony, I ask you? Horses, plus hair you can braid, plus pink, equals happy camper. There's nothing else. I sigh and climb back down the ladder. I stand for a minute, looking around. I have hundreds of memories of this place, and they are all pretty silly. Like one time when Sadie and I locked Ty out of the playhouse, and he ran around yelling through the windows, "But I'm the mailman! You have to let in the mailman!" So we told him we'd let him in if he brought us a letter or something. Therefore, he went into the house and borrowed an envelope from Dad's office, and on one side he addressed it, in crayon, to Sis, Playhouse, Our Backyard. And on the other side he wrote, "I, the male, M-A-L-E, man, let me in." We cracked up, and we let him in. I mean, how could you say no to the male man? I stifle a laugh. Mom thought it was so funny that she fashioned a little mailbox out of one of Dad's shoeboxes, with a slot on the top for Ty to slide the envelopes in. I locate the box on the little craft table in the corner. I sit down carefully in the undersized chair and take a deep breath, in case this hurts, and then I remove the lid. Inside the box, there aren't any letters from Kid Ty. Instead, I find Mom's gleaming silver sewing shears, and under them, like a long-lost treasure trove, the missing photographs. I rifle through the stack. Dad and Ty playing chess. Dad and Ty standing by the grill together one 4th of July. Dad and Ty at Carhenge one summer, which is a perfect replica of Stonehenge, except it's made of spray-painted old cars, pretending to hold one of the cars up. Dad wearing rollerblades at the parking lot. Dad giving 2-year-old Ty his first haircut. Dad's college graduation photo. Dad and Ty watching TV. Dad with an electric knife showing Ty how to carve a Thanksgiving turkey. Mom and Dad at an H&R Block company picnic. Dad pointing to a sticker on his shirt that says, "I voted." Dad teaching 6-year-old Ty how to ride a bike. Dad wiggling one of Ty's front teeth. Dad and Ty going hunting. I let out the breath I was holding. Here's the mystery right here before me, but not quite solved. All these pictures, Ty collected them. But why? I return to the top picture on the stack, Dad and Ty playing chess. It's different from the other pictures. It's smaller, for one thing. It's obviously been cut down from a 6x4 photo to a 3x3 square. It's a bit crooked, like he couldn't cut in a straight line. It has a jagged edge on one side. Then I know the answer. I get up. I go back to the house, down to the basement, to Ty's room. I get Ty's collage from behind his door and lay it on the bed. I set the chess picture on the white space of the part that's empty. It's a perfect fit. 3x3 square. Mom was right. This is where Dad's photo should have gone. Ty thought about it. He gathered up all these pictures as candidates. He decided on this one, cut it to size, but in the end he didn't put it in the frame. He wouldn't forgive Dad. I become aware of the scent of my brother's cologne. It's all around me. I close my eyes. No, I say, because I've accepted this by this point, talking to nobody in case there's somebody actually there. I won't do it, because I know what Ty would want now. He'd want me to return the picture to this frame. He'd want me to tell Dad, to make it right. I put the photo in my pocket and return the collage to its place behind the door. I turn the light off. No, I whisper to the empty room. Upstairs, I go to my closet and get out my suitcase, and I start packing. 13th of March. My dad left our family on a Tuesday morning in July. I was 15 that summer, and Ty was 13. It was 9 months before Ty would go on his little escapade with the 63 Advil and ask Dad to come home. 3 years ago now, although it feels like longer. I was brushing my teeth when it happened. Dad appeared in the mirror behind me and he said, "Hi, Lexi. You and I need to have a talk." My first thought was that he was going to lecture me about how little brain work I'd been doing that summer. That's what he called it. Not homework, but brain work. Stuff to keep my brain in shape during the months I was out of school. So I wouldn't lose anything, he always said. So I would stay sharp. But it wasn't about brain work. It was about him moving out. "Why?" I asked him, stunned. But I don't remember how he answered. I just remember that he said he was going to live at a house in town. With a woman, he said, who he'd fallen in love with. I couldn't get my head around it.
"Everything is going to be okay, Peanut," he said.
That was the last time he ever called me that. I said, "I love you, Daddy," like maybe I could talk him out of it. He said he loved me too, and he took me by the hand and led me out to the living room, where Mom was sitting on the couch, crying so hard she was having trouble breathing. I sank down beside her. Ty appeared in the doorway. He'd heard her crying from the basement. He looked scared, like he wanted to run away. Dad took him by the shoulders and walked him out to the back porch. I could see him through the window as Dad told him, his face folding in on itself as he tried to hold back his tears. Dad brought him inside. Ty sat down on the other side of Mom. He took her hand. She stopped crying long enough to say,
"Mark, don't do this."
We looked up at Dad.
"I love you all," he said.
Then he turned and walked out the front door. We listened to his truck rumble to life. We listened to it crunch down the gravel driveway. We listened to the sound of his engine getting farther and farther away. And then he was gone. Somewhere over the next few hours, the details came out. Dad had been having an affair with the secretary. Mom had known about it for months. I could see, in that hindsight is 20/20 way, that both of my parents had been acting strangely for a while. Dad working late, coming home smelling of cigarettes, Mom speaking to us more sharply than usual, trying to keep the house perfectly clean and organized, dinner on the table at precisely 6 p.m., running to reapply her lipstick when she heard him coming up the driveway. Like if everything was in place, if our home life was perfect enough, he would stop what he was doing. There were signs. I was just too caught up in my own thing to catch on. The only clue I'd noticed that summer was the dog. Our golden retriever, Sunny, had been lying around looking mournful, whimpering, not eating. "What's wrong with Sunny?" I'd asked about a week before Dad steamrolled us with the news. "I think she's depressed. Can dogs get depressed?" "I don't know," Mom had said. A lie. "Do you think they'd make Prozac for dogs?" I'd joked. And she'd laughed, which was also a lie. Mom knew that Sunny knew. The dog was there after everyone but Mom had gone to sleep. Sunny watched her cry. At some point during that day, Mom's best friend Gail showed up and tried to give my mom a pep talk. Gail's husband had divorced her a few years earlier, and I remember that she kept saying over and over, "You'll get through this, Joan. You'll be stronger for it. But Mom just shook her head, wringing the tissue in her hands into smaller and smaller shreds. We went out for pizza for dinner, because Dad never let us go out for pizza, because Dad was a tightwad. While we were eating, Ty, who'd been quiet for nearly the entire time, said, "I'm glad he's gone."
"Don't say that, honey," Mom said.
"No, I am. I'm glad,"
Ty said, his voice cracking on the word glad. That night, after Mom went to bed, Ty woke me.
"Come on,"
he said, and I didn't ask questions. I slipped into some jeans and followed him outside. Under a full moon, we walked to the park, to this rocky area behind the baseball field. Ty carried a cloth grocery bag and a metal baseball bat. He handed me the bag. It was full of bottles of Dad's old cologne.
"Put one right there,"
Ty directed. I set a bottle of Old Spice on the rocks in front of him. Ty took a deep breath. He closed his eyes like he was sending up a prayer or making a wish, then opened them again.
"He's a cheater,"
he said, and brought the bat down hard. The bottle shattered, and the smell of the cologne washed over us, so strong I felt nauseated.
"Now you."
Ty handed me the bat. I got out another bottle. Polo, my favorite on Dad. I'd given it to him for Father's Day 1 year.
"He's a liar,"
I said, and swung as hard as I could. There was a certain relief in the breaking of the glass, the shattering of something other than our pathetic little family.
"He's a cheapskate. He's a phony. He's an asshole."
Even then, though, I couldn't say the swear word with any conviction.
"He's a fraud. He's an adulterer."
We paused at this.
"I will never forgive him,"
Ty said, staring down at the reeking shards at our feet.
"I will never forgive him,"
I repeated, and it was as if we were making a vow. In a way, it felt like Dad had died. The man I knew, the quiet, gentle man who read Harry Potter out loud to me when I was 10, who helped me study for the 5th grade spelling bee, who laughed over the funnies in the Sunday newspaper, that man was gone. All that was left was the cheater, the liar, the fraud. In that moment, I knew it was true. I will never forgive him. Not ever.
"Come on,"
Ty said, slinging the bat over his shoulder. He put his arm around me. The man of the house now.
"Let's go home."
24. When Mom wakes up, I'm waiting for her.
"What's this?"
she says as she comes into the kitchen and sees me standing at the stove in her blue gingham apron, scraping an only marginally burned portion of scrambled eggs onto a plate.
"Breakfast."
She watches as I set both of our plates on the table. I take off the apron and put it back on its hook, pour us some juice, and sit down.
"Bon appetit."
She glances at the oven clock.
"This is wonderful, honey, but aren't you going to be late for school?"
"I'm not going to school today." She stares at me. I never miss school. I have a perfect attendance record, as a matter of fact, because Ty died during Christmas break. "We're going to take a trip," I announce.
"A trip?"
"You have 3 days off." I point to the work calendar she has posted to the refrigerator with magnets. "I will miss only 1 day of school." She notices the far wall of the kitchen, where I've stacked everything we'll need. Pillows and clean pillowcases and blankets to snuggle with in the car, anything resembling a snack that I could find in the pantry, a six-pack of Mom's lethal Diet Coke, which should get us through the drive there at the very least, and finally our suitcases, both fully packed, which goes to show just how Valium and or alcohol-induced my mother's sleep was last night, that I could move around her room opening and closing all her dresser drawers without her waking up. "I have it all planned out," I say. She sits down across from me.
"You want to go on some kind of road trip?"
"Yes, a road trip."
"Where?"
"You'll see." On the table, there's a stack of papers I've been reviewing, a hotel reservation and directions and other research, which I pull out of her reach.
"Just say yes, Mom."
She pushes a clump of eggs with her fork. If she doesn't agree to this,
What will come next is that she'll eat a bite or two to placate me at least that much, and then she'll go back to bed. Please, Mom, I beg. I need us to do this. I can't go back to school today. Not with how people are going to be after Patrick. I can't do it. Her lips purse for a few seconds, then relax. All right, she says resignedly. A road trip. That's the spirit. Just you and me, I say. Dave would call it quality mother-daughter bonding. She laughs weakly, not her real laugh, but as good as I'm going to get. Well, we have to do what Dave wants, don't we? Hey, you hired him, Mom. She smiles at me, a small but tender smile, and says, All right. I think it will do us both good to get out of the house. Like the whole expedition was her idea. It's raining in Memphis. We've had a long day's drive and a night in a cheap but fairly clean Super 8 motel on the edge of town, and now we've finally arrived at our final destination. The sky is a hard gray, an icy drizzle fracturing on the windshield as we pull into the parking lot. For a minute, we sit in the car with the heater blowing in our faces and look up at the sign. Graceland. My mom's always been an Elvis fan. He died on August 16, 1977, which just happened to be my mother's 8th birthday. She still remembered hearing the news about his death on the radio right after she blew out her birthday candles. From that point on, she grew up feeling a connection between herself and the king of rock and roll. So Tyler and I grew up with Elvis, too. We heard All Shook Up when she was trying to make us laugh, and Blue Suede Shoes when she was feeling sassy, and sometimes, on their anniversary or Valentine's Day, we'd catch her dancing to Love Me Tender with Dad. The week after Dad left, I kept hearing Elvis's mournful croon muffled from behind her bedroom door as she played that song again and again. Elvis was the soundtrack to her life, and by extension, mine. I've always wanted to come here, she says. I know. I put my hand on her shoulder. Let's go in. When we get inside, we're both shocked at the prices for the tour. There are three options. The basic mansion tour, which is $33, the platinum tour, where you can see Elvis's airplanes and cars and a few extra exhibits for $37, and the Graceland Elvis Entourage VIP tour, which is everything from the first two tours, with an extra private tour, front-of-the-line access, an all-day pass to the grounds and mansion, and a special keepsake backstage pass. Clearly, we've got to do the VIP tour. We've come all this way. It is $70. Per person. That's more than the hotel for the entire trip. Wow, Mom breathes as we stare up in horror at the board with the different packages on it. That is pricey. Don't worry, Mom, I say quickly, whipping out my wallet. I got it. With your MIT fund? I don't think so. She produces a gold credit card I've never seen before and ignores my raised eyebrows. I've never known my mother to buy anything on credit. The VIP tour, please, she says to the woman behind the counter, and slides the gold card across the marble. We want to see it all. Graceland is what I expected it would be. A lot of 60s and 70s glitz, bright colors, shag carpet, gold-plated handles in the bathroom of the Priscilla, Elvis's private jet. Mom and I stand in front of a fake backdrop of the famous front gates and have our picture taken. We wander from room to room, Mom oohing and awing over Elvis's jumpsuit collection and chuckling over the one room with the zebra-striped walls and red velvet couches, and standing soberly in front of his grave, staring at his death date, which is also her birth date, where it's written in stone. She's having a good time, I think, which was the point of this little adventure. I wanted to show her that it's possible to have a good time. We haven't thought about Ty for the entire day. I needed this, she says later. We've just finished dinner at a Mexican restaurant in Memphis, and Mom is slurping down a giant margarita. I'm obviously going to have to drive us back to the hotel. I really needed this. Me too, I say. Can we just not go home? she says with a sigh. We could stay here, visit Elvis every day.
I smile. I know she doesn't mean it, but this is my cue to tell her about my so-crazy-it-might-actually-work plan. You remember what Gail said about selling the house? Mom stirs her drink.
Gail always has her strong opinions, doesn't she?
I think it's a great idea.
She stops. You think we should move?
I think you should move, I elaborate. To Massachusetts. With me.
You want me to move to MIT? She says with a laugh. She thinks I'm joking. I don't think I'd fit in your twin bed.
Not my dorm room, an apartment or a little house or something. Freshmen are required to live on campus, but they make an exception if you're going to live with your parents. I reach into my backpack and pull out a sheaf of papers, which I set on the table in front of her. There are all kinds of places. This one is like a 10-minute walk to campus. 2-bedroom, washer and dryer hookups, hardwood floors. Nice, see? And it's not unaffordable. Not when you factor in that I would have been paying around $400 a month for student housing. She stares down at the paper.
You've been giving this some thought, I see. And what would I do in Massachusetts?
I rifle through the pages until I land on one with a large red brick building framed by leafy green trees. This is Mount Auburn Hospital. It's listed as one of the best places in New England for medical professionals to work, in terms of both pay and environment. It's attached to Harvard Medical School. I sit back and let her look at the About Us page I printed. It's less than 2 miles from MIT, approximately a 9-minute drive. There are currently 16 job openings for registered nurses, one in the surgical wing, like you're doing now, but that one's a night shift. Mom hates night shifts. But, I keep going before she can shoot me down, you could always start nights and move to days once you're established. Or, I bite my lip, then just come out and say it. There are 2 positions open in the maternity ward, one in labor and delivery and one in the nursery.
I could work with the babies, Mom says.
You love babies.
I do love babies,
she agrees, covering her mouth with her hand in a way that suggests she's considering it. So maybe Gail is right, just this one time, I conclude.
No.
Mom shakes her head.
No? The babies would be worse, Lexi.
How could babies be worse? Everyone's so happy around babies, it's the happiest part of the hospital.
Babies die, too. Most of the time, yes, it would be wonderful to work in maternity. But every once in a while, more often than you might think, I'd have to watch some mother lose her baby. I don't think I could live with that.
She picks up her drink, licks a piece of salt off the side of her glass.
Besides, those nurses in the nursery don't need to use their nursing skills. They change diapers and feed baby bottles and give baths all day. I want to do more than that. I want to learn. I want to be an excellent nurse, not a babysitter.
Okay, well, there are 13 other RN positions open at Mount Auburn. I'm sure you could be an excellent nurse in one of those. She finishes off her margarita, then sets the glass down and looks at me. I can tell by her face that she's going to say no.
What you've done here is very sweet, Lexi, she says. But I can't go to Massachusetts with you. You need to live this next part of your life on your own. You deserve that. You deserve to live in the dorms so you can make all of the lifelong friends you're going to make in the dorms. You need to eat at the cafeteria and stay up all night cramming for finals and go to parties and have fun without having to worry about anyone else. You need your own life.
Yes, I need my own life. But so do you, I argue. It's been kicking around in my brain ever since Sadie asked me if I was bringing my mom to college. At first, I was like, no way, who does that? But then I started to see the logic in the idea, the simple beauty of it. If Mom came to MIT with me, it wouldn't be the way I pictured it, with the late-night discussions in the dorm and strolling down the sidewalks with a group of friends, but it could be better, because then Mom wouldn't be alone, and we could escape Nebraska and what happened in our garage. We would never have to go back. We could start fresh, both of us.
My life is over, Mom says again.
I exhale a frustrated breath.
Just think about it for a while, okay? It's a good plan. If you think about it... She sits up straighter.
No. My answer is no, honey. It's always going to be no, but I love you for the offer.
Mom, this discussion is over, she says in her official mother voice. She pulls out the gold credit card.
I'll get the check.
We don't have much to say to each other for the rest of the night, or during breakfast the next morning, or in the car on the way back to Nebraska, which is going to be about an 11-hour drive. Mom drives for the first 48 minutes without saying more than, "Looks like good weather today, doesn't it?" And that's when I decide I can't take it anymore.
"Pull over," I say.
"What?"
She glances at me.
"Do you have to go to the bathroom?
You went before we left."
"No, just pull over, right here."
She brings the car to a stop at the side of the interstate.
"What's the matter? Are you feeling sick?"
"Your life is not over. That's bullshit."
Her eyes flash.
"Alexis, watch your mouth."
"It's bullshit," I say again for emphasis, and this time I'm able to swear with conviction. Ty would be proud. "You're 44 years old. The average life expectancy for a female in the United States is 81. You're not overweight, and you don't smoke, and you're drinking a lot now, but I like to think that it's a phase, and as soon as you stop feeling so fucking sorry for yourself, you'll quit doing that. And you work on your feet for most of the day, and you like vegetables, and you go to church, which studies have shown adds about 7.5 years to a person's life, and you brush your teeth. If anyone's going to live to be 100, Mom, it's you. So stop saying your life is over. It's not even halfway over. And yes, your son died, and that's awful, and that hurts, but it's not your fault. And you know what? Everybody dies, and everybody loses people they love. Everybody. And that is not an excuse for you to fucking die. I love you, and I need you to be my mother, and I need you to have a life. So get over yourself."
I take a much-needed breath. We sit there. The turn signal is still on, blinking. Cars are blasting by us at 75 miles an hour. Mom looks straight ahead.
I just said the F-word. Twice. To my mother. I called her out on her drinking. I told her to get over herself.
"Mom, I..."
She holds a hand up.
"All right," she says.
Although I don't know if she means, "All right, I've had enough. Now get out of the car and walk, you ingrate." Or, "All right, you're grounded." Or, "All right, I'll stop saying that my life is over."
"Mom?"
She sighs, then pulls the car back onto the highway.
"Would you look in my purse?" she says, after we've gone about 10 miles. "There's a book in there."
I forage through her purse until I find a small and yellowed paperback copy of To Kill a Mockingbird.
"This?"
I hold it up, surprised. She nods.
"I was supposed to read it in 8th grade. I thought maybe you could read it to me now. To pass the time."
"Okay." It's odd, but at least she's not yelling at me. I flip to the first page. "When he was nearly 13, my brother Jem got his arm badly broken at the elbow," I begin. Mom lets out a slow breath.
"Yes, I knew this would be good."
So I continue reading. For the next 7.5 hours, stopping for pee breaks and lunch, and once because Mom feels the urgent need for a Diet Coke, I read. I read about Scout and Boo Radley and Mayella Violet Ewell. I read until my voice is hoarse. When I'm done, Mom says,
"I always wanted Atticus Finch to be my father. I used to imagine it, like I was secretly adopted and Gregory Peck was my biological father."
"I thought you said you hadn't read the book."
"I saw the movie," she says. "Have you seen it?"
"Yeah, in 8th grade, I think. You're right, Gregory Peck is, like, golden. So all this time I was reading, you knew how the story was going to end."
"I wanted to hear the words," she explains. "I knew how it ended, but I wanted to go slowly and see how it would all work itself out."
She yawns against her hand.
"How about I drive for this last bit?" I offer. She pulls over and we swap places. We've gone about a mile, just outside Kansas City, when she starts to cry. I don't even notice at first, but at one point, I lean over to adjust the radio,
and noticed the wetness on her face, the trail of gleaming tears from the corner of her eye to the edge of her jaw. I smell Ty's cologne. I wonder if Mom smells it, if that's what set off her crying. "Are you okay?" I ask her gently. "We can stop." She shakes her head and exhales in a shudder, then opens up her purse and starts to dig around for her pack of tissues.
"I'm fine. It's just..."
"Smell me," says Ty's cologne. "I demand to be smelled. Smell me now." I glance in the rearview mirror, and then I see him. I see him clear as day, sitting in the back seat, his head against the window like he always used to sit, looking out. It's a miracle that I don't wreck the car. Mom says,
"It's just that I don't know why we never did that before. Graceland. All these years we've been so close, a day's drive, and we've never gone. Why didn't we?"
"Because Dad hates to travel, I think, but do not say. Look up the word homebody in the dictionary, and there will be a picture of Dad."
"We should have gone,"
Mom whispers, wiping at her face.
"We've gone now,"
I answer shakily.
"Graceland. Check." "Yes, but I wish..."
she says, and I know she wants to say we should have gone when Ty was alive. But Ty hated Elvis. He didn't appreciate being subjected to Mom's obsession with the king. He said so many times. My eyes flick back to the mirror. Ty is still there. A chill runs through me like a trickle of ice water.
"Hey, I think the lady in that red car behind us is texting," I say. "That's dangerous."
Mom turns to look. She gazes right through where Ty is curled in the back seat. She turns back to me.
"You should let her pass you. It's always better to be behind the road hazard."
I let the red car pass. Mom gives a disapproving look to the driver, but the lady doesn't notice. I try to keep my hands steady on the wheel. Mom gets a tissue out of her purse and blows her nose. The tears keep coming, an endless river of grief. Ty stays with us, too. All the way back to Nebraska. 25. I wait. Until we're unpacked. Until we've eaten dinner. Until Mom is asleep. Then I slip down into Ty's room. It's quiet. I look at the mirror, the clock radio, the shadow in the corner cast by the closet door. He's not here. But I want him to be.
"I want to talk to you," I say. "Ty."
Silence.
"Come on."
"We can't run away, right? That's what you were telling me today? That you're always going to be there, hanging out in the back seat? Your smell, your shadow, your memory. That's what you were trying to tell me, right? Well, I have things I want to say to you." I sit at his desk and turn on the desk lamp, which is like a spotlight in the dark.
"Come on, Ty. I did what you wanted. I gave the letter to Ashley. Now do what I want for once."
But there's nothing. No sound, no smell, no tie, which pisses me off even more. And it's been a ranting kind of day. I stand up.
"You're selfish," I say into the darkness. "Do you know that? You're the most selfish person I know. You didn't even care, did you, about what this would do to Mom? Did you hear her saying her life is over? That's on you. That's on you, Ty. You're no better than Dad is, you know? You just do whatever you feel like doing and to hell with the rest of us, right?"
My eyes are drawn to the mirror. For a split second, I think I see him, a dark shape moving, but then I realize it's my own reflection. I stare at the post-it. "Sorry, Mom, but I was below empty."
"What? You wanted to make some kind of grand romantic statement? You wanted to demonstrate to the world how much pain you were in?"
The hole starts to crack open in my sternum, but I push past it.
"It's not romantic. You blew a chunk of your chest out and died in a puddle of your own blood. Does that sound romantic to you? The people cleaned it up, yeah, all right, but they left a bunch of soaked bloody paper towels in the garbage outside for Mom to find when she emptied the trash the next week. Romantic, right? What an awesome statement. Oh, and your body loses control of its bowels when you die, and you shit yourself. How fucking romantic is that? And the little girl next door, Emma, you know, she came outside when the ambulance drove up, and she was there when they opened the garage door and she saw you like that. She's 6 years old. Awesome statement you made there. Right this second, you are worm food, and people have forgotten you. They don't even remember you now. It's all Patrick Murphy now, but they'll forget him, too. They'll move on. That's what people do. You aren't Jim Morrison, Ty. You don't get to be some kind of tragic rock star who died young and everyone builds a shrine to. You get to be a stupid-ass kid. The only people who will remember your statement are Mom and me, and that's just because we hurt too much to forget. Yeah, other people are in pain too, dipshit. Everybody feels pain. You asshole. I tear the Post-it off the glass. The hole is an enormous chasm in my chest now, a swirling black hole, but I fight it. I do not accept this shitty little note. I crumple the Post-it. I drop it. It falls from my fingers and bounces on the floor and out of sight. My vision goes dim around the edges. I can't breathe. Then I'm on my knees on the floor with my face pressed to the musty carpet fibers, and I see blue lights behind my eyes, constellations of pain. But I don't see Ty. "Where are you?" I wheeze into the floor. "Where did you go?" The hole passes. I don't know how long it takes, but suddenly it's simply gone. I turn my face to the side and cough and lie there in the fetal position until I feel enough strength return to my body to sit up. The first thing I do is get on my hands and knees next to the bed and search for the Post-it. To smooth it out, to put it back, because I can't stay angry at him. Instead, my fingers close on something hard and sharp. I jerk back, then reach underneath the bed carefully and pull the object out. It's a tooth. A shark tooth necklace, to be more precise. The necklace part consists of a row of tiny black beads on a rough string, with a single white and jagged tooth gleaming in the center. I sit up on my knees to inspect it, frowning. I bring it into the beam of light from the lamp. You don't encounter shark teeth every day in our part of Nebraska, or any part of Nebraska. Landlocked state, if you recall. I don't remember this necklace. Ty wasn't the kind of guy who wore necklaces, period. "What is this?" I ask to the empty air. And then I remember where I've seen it before. The picture of the three amigos, Ty, Patrick, and Damien, making the peace sign. I pull Ty's collage out from behind the door and find the picture in question. It was taken at the Henry Dorley Zoo in Omaha. Nebraska may not have too much in the way of snazzy tourist destinations, but we do have one of the best zoos in the country. I have always liked the gorilla exhibit, but Ty's favorite was the sharks. It's a huge blue tunnel where hammerheads and black tips and grays and about 10 other species of shark sweep through the water around you like they are performing a slow aquatic ballet. Ty would sometimes stand in there watching the sharks for hours. I used to tease him about it. "Who loves sharks?" I'd ask him. "If you got tossed in there, I doubt they'd love you back. Two words, feeding frenzy."
"It's peaceful," was all he said in his defense. "I like it."
The Three Amigos photo was taken just outside the entrance to the shark tunnel. They must have been on a class field trip because they are each wearing a fluorescent green badge. They are also each wearing a shark tooth necklace from the gift shop. I stare at their hopeful faces. I close my hand around the shark tooth. Ty, Patrick, Damien. Three links in a chain. 15th of March. The first time I thought there might be something wrong with Ty, the first time it occurred to me that he might be looking at the dying young scenario a little too fondly, was when Samantha Sullivan, a girl from our church, died of pneumonia. Samantha was a sweet girl, the type who I always remembered smiling. She had braces, but they only seemed to accentuate her smile in a good way. When she got sick, nobody thought she would die. People we know don't die of pneumonia, not in this day and age, not 14-year-old violin players. She was in the hospital for a few days and scheduled to be discharged on a Monday. On Sunday morning, she developed a blood clot in her lung. On Sunday afternoon, part of the clot broke free and traveled to her brain. And then she was dead. Samantha hadn't been super popular. She was quiet. She had a small group of close friends, like me. She didn't like to call attention to herself.
but it seemed like every teenager in the city of Lincoln came to her funeral. One of her friends made a playlist of all her favorite songs, Taylor Swift mostly, with some Carrie Underwood and the Pistol Annies thrown in. Samantha liked country. The playlist looped all through the viewing before the funeral. Samantha's mom bought several of those collage frames and filled them with photos. Samantha as a baby, Samantha canning tomatoes with her grandmother, Samantha on the beach of Branched Oak Lake with a line of cousins, Samantha eating ice cream with her friends, smiling her sparkly smile. At the funeral, the people who got up to speak kept referring to Samantha's gentle spirit and how she was a light that had gone out too soon, but how she was home now. There was no sickness that could touch her. She was safe. She had run her race. They tried to make it sound like life completely blows, so thank goodness Samantha got out of it when she did, while she was ahead, so to speak. No tears in heaven. I remember thinking, why? If God's so good, why take this girl before she's even had a chance to live? It didn't make sense. It still doesn't. Ty took Samantha's death hard. He spent the rest of the summer playing Taylor Swift songs over and over. He had a picture of Samantha, taken at a church potluck when they were both about 12, sitting on a lawn chair with a paper plate balanced delicately across her knees, about to dig into some potato salad. He tacked the picture up on his wall next to his bed. It's still there. What was weird was that he and Samantha hadn't been particularly close. Yes, they had known each other since they were kids, and that much was upsetting in itself. Nothing can remind you of your own fragile place in the universe so powerfully as someone your own age dying suddenly. Here one minute, gone the next. But the level of emotion Ty showed over Samantha's death didn't correlate with what he'd felt for her in real life. He hated country music. He wasn't friends with any of her friends. So why did it settle into him so deeply? In life, Samantha had been small and unassuming, a person who gravitated toward the background. But in death, she was a shining star. Everyone spoke well of her. Everyone cried for her. They all cared. I've wondered lately if that was what started Ty's fascination in his own death. He saw how everyone that one afternoon in the church, in the graveyard, loved Samantha Sullivan. It was only a few weeks later that he took the Advil. Maybe he didn't mean to die. I mean, he took the pills practically under Mom's nose. Who does that unless you want to get caught, to get saved? Maybe he was like everybody else. He just wanted to be loved. But then after he swallowed the pills, he went down into his bedroom and went to sleep. Something must have changed in those moments after he took the Advil. There were other factors, too. A few days after Samantha's death, a football player at UNL killed himself in the empty locker room after a game, an overdose of some kind of over-the-counter drug. It was all over the news. That same summer, a meth head died in what the press called suicide by police. He pretended he had a gun, and they shot him. There were all kinds of places where the idea might have taken root. That scene in the Twilight series when Edward tries to kill himself when he thinks he's lost Bella. Because, yes, that's a perfectly reasonable response if you can't be with the person you love. Just die. Or the casual way people roll off the phrase, I'm killing myself doing fill in the blank. Or Dr. Kevorkian. Or the death penalty, or the news, which is always spewing out some kind of terrible story about a crazy person with a gun and a death wish. Or Romeo and Juliet in English class, or It's Kind of a Funny Story, or a collection of poems by Sylvia Plath on Mom's bookshelf from her college days, where she had underlined the lines, Dying is an art like everything else. I do it exceptionally well. I do it so it feels like hell. I do it so it feels real. There's death all around us, everywhere we look. 1.8 people kill themselves every second. We just don't pay attention. Until we do. 26. Going back to school on Monday is rough. Even the bus ride is unbearable. Everybody wants to stare at the girl whose brother died, who must be extra fragile now because someone else is dead. It's how they treated me when I came back after Christmas break,
like I've got a grief bomb strapped to my chest, liable to go off at any second. They either approach me carefully to attempt to defuse it, or they run for cover. Plus, it's St. Patrick's Day, which makes the whole thing super awkward. Nobody's wearing green, I notice. Fun times. I look for Damien in the halls before class. I can't stop thinking about his voice when he was telling me that Patrick was dead. He was my friend, he said. Now he's the only one of the three amigos left standing. But I don't spot him. Of course, he's easy to miss when he's trying not to be seen. Invisibility is his superpower, after all.
If I disappeared one day, really disappeared, and never came back, they wouldn't even notice.
That's what he said to me that day in the gym. And I said, I see you. That's what I have to do. He needs me to see him. I cyber-stalked Damien a bit over the weekend to figure out how I might best do that, be his friend. And this is what I've gleaned from his internet activity so far. He's into photography, especially black and white candids, photos taken when the subject didn't know there was a camera. I already knew that. He likes to read. I already knew that, too. What I didn't know is that Damien likes to read everything he can get his hands on. Science fiction and fantasy and horror, but also books like Marley and Me and The Kite Runner, and books about Descartes and Kant and Jung. He's really into philosophy. He describes himself as a philosopher-poet on his various online profiles, and I don't know if this is simply an attempt to pick up girls, but that's the term he uses. Philosopher. Poet. Which is great and all, except 3 days ago, he posted this poem. A white bone picked clean by the carrion few who will never know the pain that I do. I worry that he could be the next domino to fall. He could be trembling on the brink of Ty's oblivion, about to step off into the abyss. I don't know. I don't know how to make things better for him. But I'm going to try. I find him at lunchtime. He's sitting at a table in the corner of the cafeteria, all alone, glumly picking at a pile of soggy French fries. So, I say, sliding into a chair across from him like it's what I do every day, I want to talk about Heart of Darkness. I thought it was so interesting the way Conrad explores how a person chooses between two different kinds of evil. So relevant, don't you think? Thank you, Cliff's Notes. Damien's face brightens, and he says,
I know. I think he was writing about the absurdity of it all. I mean, how can there be such a thing as insanity in a world that's already gone insane?
I know, I agree enthusiastically. So, I add, I was wondering if you could give me some reading recommendations now that I'm done with Conrad. I really liked that one. What else could I try? His eyebrows come together thoughtfully, considering what I might like.
Have you read Kafka?
He asks after a minute. Kafka. I jot the name down in my notebook.
Classic existentialism. Start with The Metamorphosis. It's short, but it's brilliant.
Short is good, I think. Short is very good. I will check it out. Literally, I say. I reach across the table and pop one of his French fries into my mouth. Damien smiles, a real, genuine smile, revealing a row of crooked teeth. I'm so happy to see that smile. In Honor's calculus lab, when, after our initial 10 minutes of homework, we pair up to play a blackjack tournament, winner gets cookies of their choice baked by none other than the multi-talented Miss Mahoney, Stephen asks if he can challenge me in the first round. I can't think of a good excuse not to. At least Stephen's reaction to me is genuine, even if it is awkward. Okay. I pull my desk to face his.
Dealer or player?
He asks. Dealer. He hands me the deck.
Are you doing all right?
He asks as I shuffle. Here we go. The bomb squad interrogation has officially begun. I'm fine.
You miss school. You never miss school.
Never say never, I joke, but he doesn't laugh.
I tried to call you.
I went on an impromptu road trip with my mom. His eyebrows furrow.
A road trip? Where?
Tennessee.
More furrowing. Tennessee.
Yes, are you ready?
He nods. I lay a card face up in front of him, and one face down in front of me. A 9 for him, a 2 for me. I lay down one more for him. A 5, then one more for me, face up. A jack.
What's in Tennessee?
He asks. I consider telling him that it's none of his business, but I know he's asking because he's worried. In spite of everything, he still cares about me. I shouldn't throw that back in his face.
Graceland, I answer softly. We went to Graceland.
His eyes light up with understanding.
Because your mom loves Elvis.
I can't help a smile.
Because my mom loves the king.
Awesome.
He smiles too, relaxes his shoulders.
That's great.
So, the cards, I say, trying to get us back on track, because other pairs are finishing up now and ready to move to round 2. He glances at the cards.
Okay, hit me again.
I do. It's a 6, which puts him at 20. He passes, and I'm at 12, so I draw one more for myself, a king. 22. Bust. It's over. He wins. Congratulations, I say. Mahoney makes a killer chocolate chip. That's what I'd pick.
Hey, let's not get ahead of ourselves, he replies. I've merely won the battle, not the war.
But he goes on to win the next 3 hands, and he does pick the chocolate chip. I told you so, I say as we're leaving the classroom. Beaker and Elle fall into step behind us, but they hang back and let us talk, which feels weird, but what am I going to do about it? Stop and insist that we walk all together?
Yes, yes you did,
he says.
How did you know?
Clairvoyant, I explain, tapping my temple like my brain is something magical.
Ah.
For a minute, things feel like they used to be. Before, I mean, when we were friends.
So, I know you haven't felt like being involved in math club lately,
he says as we round the corner into the commons.
But we're all going bowling tomorrow night. Parkway Lanes, 6 p.m. Be there or be square.
Well, you know I'm a square, I joke. Stephen shifts his backpack to the other shoulder and stops to squint at me.
I'd say you were more rectangular.
You're so sweet, I say.
So you'll come.
For once, I really wish I could. I can't, I tell him. I have the stupid dinner with my dad. Which is really the last place I want to be, considering. But that's the rule. I eat dinner with Dad on Tuesday nights. If I start breaking the rules now, who knows what could happen. Stephen tries to look like he's not disappointed.
Okay, fair enough. Another time, then.
Yeah, I murmur. Another time. 17th of March. This is going to sound trite, I suppose, but you never know when it's going to be the last time that you hug someone, that you kiss, that you say goodbye. I don't know what my last words were to Ty. Probably something like, smell you later, as I went out the door that morning. I can't remember. It wasn't significant, is all I know. We were never one of those families that says, I love you at the end of every conversation, just in case. Stephen's parents do that. When he calls to tell them he's going to be late or something, he always ends by saying, I love you too, even if he'll see them in 10 minutes. I used to think that was the tiniest bit lame. If you say something that often, it loses its meaning, doesn't it? But now I understand. If the unthinkable happens, a car accident, a heart attack, whatever, at least you'll know your last words were something positive. There's a security in that, a comfort. I broke up with Stephen on New Year's Eve. There was a party at his house with his family, his 3 sisters and his parents and his aunts and uncles and cousins and half-cousins once removed. That night, they treated me like a china doll. Poor, dear Alexis with the broken life. Then we were counting down to New Year's and I thought, this will be the first year without Ty in it in 3, 2, 1. Stephen leaned in to kiss me, and I flinched away. I'm sorry, I remember I said. I can't.
It's okay, he said. I get it.
No, you don't. I wished he would stop being so understanding with me for once. I don't mean this.
I mean us. I can't do it anymore.
So many emotions crossed his face, but he swallowed them all down.
Okay.